cold. That's what I need.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. This is issue 112. Essentially, this is the extreme issue. Yeah, this is the extreme issue with an X.
Extreme.
I think we're all, I know we brought, Rick, are you out there?
Yeah, I am.
As Rick Gutierrez, a special guest tonight to talk about this.
Extreme podcaster.
That's right. Extreme.
Tonight, everything is extreme.
Everything is extreme. Everything is Zubaz and hypercolor shorts and shirts.
Oh, dear Lord.
Yeah.
With chromium covers.
With chromium covers. Tonight, we talk about the 90s, if you haven't guessed yet. You listened to us on the 80s. Jedi Cole, are you out
in
there?
In the 90s, I actually had on my bed for sheets chromium covers.
Did you? Did you get cut with those? Did you try to get into bed?
It was awful, yeah.
It was awful. So the Jedi Cole Houston is with us, as always. Say hello, Jedi Cole.
I'm a veteran of all of the comic caves that we're talking about.
That's right. I can only claim four of the five. Cole's got me beat. And with us tonight is Rick Gutierrez, who... who is a staunch supporter of 90s comics.
I'm not a staunch supporter of 90s comics. Let's set the record straight here.
Well, then why are you on here? I need a staunch supporter of 90s comics.
At the time, I had just started collecting at the 90s, so this catches me right.
That actually gives you a unique perspective.
Yeah, this catches me right.
You were forced to love. Because that's all you have.
It was. What do they call that? The syndrome that prisoners get with it.
Yeah, it's like a Helsinki.
Yeah, you got comic book Helsinki.
What to associate with your captain?
Well, all right. Before we get into that, we have a few addendums to the last issue because there was so much that happened in the 80s that we went back and looked at the notes of what we wanted to talk about, and we dropped the ball on a few things.
Each one was right. They were the big 80s.
They were. I'm going to let Cole do this. What were a few things that we missed, and we're just going to bullet point these.
Looking over my notes, just some bullet points. Akira was one that I'm kicking myself because that was published in Japan in the 80s, and in many ways, I think personally, that was the first time where I really saw manga and anime. I mean, you know, granted, we have things like Speed Racer and other and like King Kong. Cartoons that had been imported years and years earlier.
Right.
But I don't think that it really took off until things like Akira got heavily marketed in the States, and then it was just insanity.
Followed by things like Ghost in the Shell, and then all of a sudden the floodgates opened. And
exactly, and it happened. It was sort of a two-pronged approach there. One if by anime, two if by manga. Double process. They're coming by anime and manga.
There were lanterns and windows. Just it doesn't make sense.
Right.
It doesn't make sense.
Makes more sense now. Kitty Pryde was introduced in the pages of X-Men.
Right.
Who would want to become Sprite, Shadow Cat, Hello Kitty, I think, at one point.
Professor Pryde at one point.
Yeah,
later.
Professor Pryde, that's what she is now.
Mm-hmm.
So you have... You know, you got that going for you. Another one that was just, you know, kicking ourselves for having let this slip by was the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. With apologies to Eddie Medina.
Right.
Of Figment and the Rancor Pit.
And if you want to know how we feel about that, we do have an entire issue dedicated to it. So we can fall back on our dedication to
We didn't exactly give the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles a short shrift. And characters like, you know, Jason Todd was introduced. I don't know if we mentioned that. On a personal Master of Kung Fu level, Gene Day passed away,
yeah.
So I could blame that on Shakespeare.
But yeah, so we missed a few things, but, you know, the 80s were big enough to allow us to miss a few things and still get a solid hour of show out of it, so thank you, 80s.
The 80s were huge. I mean, you had your Days of Future Past, you had everything. I mean, you had some of the crown jewels in comicdom come out in the 80s, for sure.
Yeah, like Secret Wars, right, Rick? You love that.
I'm not even going to go there.
So the reason that if you've ever listened to the show, Rick's been a regular reoccurring guest on the show, and we never give him any end of rash of shit for his love of Image in 90s comics. And tonight,
but it,
I asked,
it came by it honestly. And one more thing, speaking of Image, that we forgot to mention in talking about the 80s, is this marked the biggest boom. It marked that it was like the launching pad,
right,
for the indie comic to come of its own.
Right.
I mean, there had always been indie comics, but most of them were comics spelled COMIX, and you know, featured like the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers. But by the 80s, you're starting to see this sudden surge of indies because the success of Eastman and Laird's Mirage Studios, for example.
Yeah. In quotation marks.
This is viable.
Right. We can
and
do this.
And there are all kinds of little success stories where, you know, the indie black and white comics were what was it? The World's Toughest Milkman. I can't remember what the...
Well, there was...
Didn't The Tick also make its debut during the 80s?
I think that was more 90s. I'll have to look. Reed Fleming, The World's Toughest Milkman, premiered in the 80s. I think Flaming Carrot comics may have
got its start in the 80s, the late 80s, nonetheless.
I think Milk and Cheese also... No,
that was 90s.
Milk and Cheese is very 90s.
Yeah.
In fact, you're right, Rick. Actually, The Tick premiered in 1986.
That's
what I thought.
As the newsletter mascot of New England Comics Shop.
Oh, wow.
He then branched off into New England Comics, actual publishing house, and began to publish The Tick.
There you go.
And Ben Edlund made good. He recently, if you saw the latest Gotham, was actually... the screenplay was written by none other than Ben Edlund.
It makes sense too. It's just super creepy.
Yeah,
it was awesome. By the way, if you haven't seen the Gotham that we're talking about, it's the spirit of the goat.
Oh yeah, the goat.
Good God, man, that was creepy. All right, so this issue we are going
now
to cover.
We're jumping right into the middle of the 90s, and that's a whole different.
Right. And the question I have, the reason that I wanted to do this particular issue was this question. We have done many a show defaming the 90s.
Oh, sure, yeah.
We have done many a show defaming certain aspects of the 90s, and those things still stand. Mm-hmm. And they will be brought up on this show. But were the 90s really that bad is the question I want to ask. It's a little different than the first two.
That's a very good question.
Yeah, it's different than the first two we did in this story arc, but are the 90s really that bad?
I'm going
to
argue...
You pointed everything that was wrong, but there were right things.
Right.
I'm going to argue that it's not so much that they started, that they were bad from the onset, because they were not.
Okay.
I mean, you have some amazing work done by some amazing artists at the time. Tom McFarlane's Spider-Man, Jim Lee with X-Men, Mark Silvestri with Uncanny X-Men, Rob Liefeld with X-Force, as much as I know you guys love the trash on Rob Liefeld. Everybody's work at this time was like the cream of the crop. Will Sportaccio with Uncanny as well.
Well, see, my issue with all of those artists, and it's not that they were bad, it's that we come from this Neil Adams, Perez, Wolfman, in the 80s sort of idea of realism, almost, into this theater of the extravagant in the 90s.
It became, like, very edgy.
Well, it wasn't even that it was edgy. It was just over... It was way over the top.
Everybody was over-accessorized or over... You know, there were more elements to everybody's costume.
I agree.
The only person who put more things in somebody's costume was Jack Kirby.
Well, and then there were muscles where muscles never, ever were to appear, and never will appear again, you know, in the work of Lee.
It's like people complaining about the anatomy of Milo Manara's Spider-Woman cover.
Right.
And if you look at any given action shot of Spider-Man as drawn by McFarlane, the human foot, hand, arm, leg, head, neck, spine, no matter how super-powered you are, it's like there were extra muscles or extra bones.
Right,
or
the muscles on the page were only confined by the imagination of the artist. There was no actual physiology involved
there. So I think there was sort of a departure in, I mean, I think, you know, 10 or 20 years earlier, these artists would not have been employed.
Well, but professionally. But isn't that the and not to be and here's the thing, isn't that the point of the 90s?
Yeah.
Was to be over the top, to really be excessive. Everything was in excess in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from the comics, the writing, the business model, everything up until the crash, which I think that it all led up to that crash, but everything up to that crash was just excess, extreme, over the top. Led Zeppelin in a hotel room.
Perfect example. Torment, the first five issues of Spider-Man, were some of the darkest, most disturbing things I've ever read in a Spider-Man book.
Okay.
And it was filled with more blood than I ever remembered in a Spider-Man comic from the 80s.
But you know, to give a counterpoint to that particular storyline, Kraven's Last Hunt was far more compelling and far darker.
True.
Than Torment.
But it wasn't gory to the point of, like, disgust, though.
Yeah, that's another thing is, it's funny, we talked in the previous issue about the lifting of the comics code or the diminishing of the Comics Code authority and what it stood for.
Mm-hmm.
And you do see in fact, that somewhere in the 80s or the 90s, I think, there was a Master of Kung Fu special that was published called Shang-Chi Bleeding Black.
Wow.
And a lot of people won't really get that reference, but what that was referring to is if you go back and look at most of the comics in that era, if Shang-Chi beat the crap out of somebody or vice versa, they would just be like, dripping blood, but it looked like, the octopus had sprayed all over them. Because you weren't allowed to show a lot of red blood.
Because of the code.
Because of the comics code authority. Mm-hmm. That was an old throwback. And so once, those restrictions are gone, then, it does open up to... But you're also looking at, culturally, this is the era of the slasher film.
Mm-hmm.
So you see this sort of desensitizing to violence through the entertainment media.
Well, it's the decade of, in film and on TV, it was the decade of just everything became over the top and everything became hyper-violent.
And their excuse was, it's the 90s.
Right. It became the RoboCop of decades.
Yeah. In fact, when pressed, they would say, how many years, how many decades, how many centuries we've been waiting for 1990 to get here?
Right.
So that we could do this, and now it's here? How dare you? It's the 90s. We've earned this.
So what important events happened in the 90s that brought us to where we are now? What launching pads, what lodestones were invented, were created?
I think this was, for one thing, the point where the Punisher gets elevated even beyond just having a monthly. Going from a bit character in a Spider-Man story to, eventually getting his own title and his own mythos, to the point where he's not only getting one, but two or three or four titles.
Right.
And that's super stardom. That's Spider-Man level stardom.
Yeah.
When apparently your adventures are so heavy and constant that it takes two or three or four books to cover them all, like
right.
Superman.
But the flip off to and that was, we saw a lot of the darker characters get that treatment, and we saw a lot of characters that weren't particularly dark go dark in the 90s. We saw a definite trend toward darkness in Batman.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't make Superman any darker, so they killed him.
Yeah.
Spider-Man got a lot darker in the 90s, and then got cloned, I believe. No, that wasn't, was that the 90s, or was that the...
No, that was the 90s.
That was the 90s, okay.
know, everything.
Now, the thing about it is, what's weird is it's hard to define the 90s in comics, because you can point, much like in the 80s, you could point at certain things, and you can point at this darkness and grittier, gorier type of thing, but at the same time, there's also the fun stuff.
Which is like, what's
how
important.
How do you reconcile both of those happenings simultaneously?
Well, what are some of the fun things that happened in 90s comics?
Well, you've got... Rise
of the Superman. I mean, the follow-up story to the death of Superman was a lot of fun.
Right.
And yeah, and they did follow that with like breaking the Superman titles up and starting to do something really interesting where you had four Superman titles after he returned. Mm-hmm. And if you read all four of them, it was the first cross-company crossover that worked. Because if you read all four titles, you read a complete story month to month.
Very much so.
Where you didn't have the kind of disconnect you get with him, like, we're going to force you to buy all the annuals, even though all of them have only the most tenuous connection. You saw Robin really come of his own as a character mm-hmm. again for the first time since the 80s, when Dick Grayson as Robin led the Teen Titans and elevated Robin beyond just a kid in Python pants.
That's mm-hmm. true. That's true. Let him. And we saw that a lot in the 90s. We saw a lot of growth. That one thing that the 90s did, the one thing that the opulence of the 90s did was allow writers and creators to take a bunch of ideas that otherwise wouldn't have been monopolized on and go mm-hmm. crazy with the idea. You know, kind of free reign, go do what you're going to do. The two teams of X-Men, X-Men Blue and Gold, led to a lot of really kind of interesting ideas. Not all of them great, not all of them bad, but interesting ideas that had never been explored before. Idea. Go ahead.
Talking about just the fun stuff. You had the Justice Society became
right.
viable again.
Right.
You know, people wanted to read about the old school characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very successful. And then, you know, Robin gets his own title. There's all kinds of stuff. I mean, granted, the Robin book probably veered a little darker here and there. But, you know, Metamorpho got his own comic for a while. Catwoman. That was another weird thing. Is you started seeing, like, Catwoman and Venom. You got villains getting their own books. And it wasn't just, like, super villain team up. This is like, you know, Catwoman's going to tell a story for the next several years.
Right.
How does that work?
Yeah.
And not to mention, in 96, we get to see something that probably the most out there thing since Watchmen, and probably the most influential comic, in my opinion, since Watchmen, and that was Kingdom Come.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You got to see, and literally, the idea of Kingdom Come was something that I don't think anybody could have ever thought of besides the people who actually thought of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it was one of those things that was so far afield of what comics had been up to that point that you were going to tell this story that you were going to couch in within Elseworlds, which was a big thing of the 90s as well, let's not forget.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point where DC decided if you want to tell alternate reality stories, we spent a lot of time and trouble having the Crisis on the Infinite Earths.
Yeah.
You know, back in the 80s, do us a favor. We'll put it here. It never happened.
Never happened, except for when it does.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And what we saw
that's
was this idea of an imperfect future led by the propping up of these superhuman people as gods. And it's just the brilliantly articulated story, brilliant art. It's one of those books, like it's sort of my version of Watchmen after a fashion, where I can go back and read it 1,000 times, and every one of those times I read it, I'm going to find something new or different or pick up
exactly.
on something, you know,
but
some tone.
The other thing is, you know, we talked in the previous issue about the Me Too, so like especially Secret Wars being the Me Too for Crisis.
Right.
The kind of, you know, John Schlesinger rushes out his version, well, mine's still a chemist. But in a way, Kingdom Come was a Me Too that said, you know, I want to do something on this same scale as someone else has done, but
yeah.
I'm not trying to do the same thing. And what I'm getting at is Marvels from 1994.
Yeah, yeah.
Because what Marvel's did was something no one had ever done before, and that's tell the story of your universe from ground level, from the perspective of the average Joe. And in both cases, you have an everyman character, but each of them are telling a vastly different story. They're not trying to mimic one. You know, the one isn't trying to mimic the other.
Oh, true. Very true. I remember collecting Marvels when it was coming out, and I loved that story.
It was see, I have my issues with Marvels, but I really liked Kingdom Come more than Marvels as a Me Too situation.
Mm-hmm.
I think Marvels did its job. I think it found its place, but I don't think it was as.
I think now that I'm older, you know, and a few years have passed, I prefer Kingdom Come to Marvels. However, the artwork at the time for Marvels was just wow.
It was unprecedented.
And it was
because
amazing.
That was Alex Ross's first big. It wasn't his first published work, but it was his first big, full-scale project.
Yeah, it was
and
his
the
first
thing
big
is,
gig.
Where Marvels differs is that it is mired in being a period piece.
Mm-hmm.
It can only tell the stories of the characters that would have existed within the time frame.
Mm-hmm.
That is, from your Golden Age, from your Invaders era.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then through on into the early X-Men, early Avengers, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to remain true to the time period that,
yeah.
in which it takes place, where there was freedom in Kingdom Come to extrapolate beyond. And the fun thing with that was to try to pick out who is the new version of who, and
right.
who is the older version of who.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like, when you suddenly realize, oh my god, that's the original Teen Titans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all kind of getting together. Or the original new Teen Titans. Cause, you know,
yeah.
So, obviously, the guy, the golden athlete guy must be Cyborg, even though there's so much implicit
yes.
that isn't expressed. And it presupposes the audience knows their stuff enough to figure that out.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's something, you know, as we go on here that I do want to discuss, and that is the birth of Image Comics.
Okay.
We have discussed Image Comics at great length on this show. Again, we've given Rick no end of shit for Image, but in Rick's defense, you know, I had most of the Image Comics myself. Image did a lot of not great for the industry, but I don't think that they get enough credit for what they did well.
I think, well, let's get the bad over with, okay, before we get into the good. Because they...
Do we have time to get the bad over with?
Oh!
I'll touch on it.
I tease because I love.
That's right.
I'll touch on it briefly. I mean, there was...
You can touch on it all you want.
Yeah, I know. It was notorious for being completely late.
Yes.
Almost every month on a regular basis. And
very few of the partners managed. They discovered, I think, or without really admitting as much,
mm-hmm.
that having an editorial staff was actually something that was important.
Right.
Yeah. The biggest hurt came from the Wildstorm part of it. Wildcats and Wetworks, and the reason is because one issue into Wetworks, Will Sportaccio's sister died.
Yeah.
And it took a huge hit on both him, on Jim Lee, on anybody who was close to Will's. I mean, it hit them all hard because she was friends with all of them.
Right.
And, you know, understandably so. And then at the same time, I believe it was issue 3 or 4 that Jim Lee's wife had their first baby.
Yes.
And he actually talks about it in the intro to the book, which was on the inside of the cover.
But that's the thing about... Here's my devil's advocate to what you're saying.
Yeah, go ahead.
When you go into business to create, to start creating comic books, you're going into a comic book business.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say then, oh, well, I had a baby, I can't uphold my obligations.
Mm-hmm.
You still have to follow through with your obligations. You've got people relying on you to follow through with your obligations.
Oh, of course.
That's why when something like that happens in one of the big two or any of the other ones, they find somebody to fill that gap until you can get back to doing what you were doing, or they just replace you on that book and you get to take another book when you can.
Yeah.
The problem these guys ran into was that they approached this idea, for better or worse, as if they were rock stars in a band. And, you know, we're going to go do this, and it's going to be awesome, and I'm going to do Wrangler commercials or whatever, Lee's Jeans commercials, whatever LaFell did, Calvin Klein.
Lee Jeans. Yeah, Lee Jeans.
And created X-Force? Huh?
But they realized along the way, like Cole said, that having an editorial staff and having a copy room and having, you know, all of these things are tantamount to, or paramount, actually, creating comics and getting them out on time.
Well, the thing is, you know, the dream of going into business for yourself does not relieve you of being in business.
Right. No, I agree. Okay, so it was issue two that he talks about the baby, which delayed him there. So delay on issue three and four, or it was supposed to be a three-issue run of Wildcats originally. It ended up being expanded to four because the reason was that Topps promotional cards weren't finished because of delays in producing all the new artwork for the set.
So because the trading cards weren't finished, the comic didn't get put out.
The comic didn't get put out. And then issue four, that was around the time of the death of Wilson's sister.
Yeah. So,
but
well,
even that notwithstanding, there were their entire production staff were plagued with delays because they didn't. You almost got the sense of like you're going to buy this no matter what, so leave us alone. Were, you know, like Andy was saying, they took the approach, they were like Death Clock from Metalocalypse. You know, they were just, their loyal fans were just going to remain and do their bidding.
Well, because they're metal, and, you know, that's why.
Yeah, it was very metal of them to do that.
I actually have a polybag issue, still sealed, of Wildcats number 4, and the card is a holofoil stamped card of Grifter and Zealot. And then on the back, is one of the worst mistakes that Image ever did,
which was
Deathmate.
Yes, indeed. But you know, it's funny. You should bring up the poly bag with the trading card, with the foil and the stamps and the FUD, because that's one of the things that really, if you want to find a defining element of the 90s.
Oh, sure.
There was a movement that, I forget who it was, someone of some note in the industry, a writer or artist, one of the two, started a campaign called Frag the Bag.
Oh, God, yeah, I remember that.
Because it was getting to the point where the gimmickry was reaching epidemic levels. And it, you know, it wasn't that, you know, some little indies were trying to attract you with shiny baubles. Everybody was.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think the only company, no, I stand corrected, nobody...
nobody wasn't trying to do it at that point.
Even Dark Horse, to some degree, was trying to lure people in. They did limited edition covers for the... as gifts to the retailers who bought more than, like, 25 copies of the various Comics Greatest World titles.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, it's almost embarrassing that, you know, Marvel's, one of the finest works to come out of Marvel Comics, is a prime example of...
Yes.
Their original plan with that, you know, they had that acetate cover that just has the title. And then, you know, the clever thing is it makes it look like, oh, I get it. You can get rid of all the indicia, and it's all the art.
Yeah.
Nothing in the way. But the thing that it is, the sad truth of it is... they failed miserably trying to put that art onto an acetate cover.
What
they wanted was art on acetate.
And that doesn't work.
No, it doesn't.
patently impossible. So what they came up with was something that looked like a really cool idea that was actually
a mistake.
Just a byproduct of a failed attempt, yeah. But, you know, the gimmicks, we talked in the previous issue about how the paper stocks began to drive up the production cost and ultimately the price of your favorite comics. Then you started having to foot the bill for this childish pissing contest between all the publishers to see who could out-gimmick each other. One of the absolute worst was Eclipso number one from DC, which had glued to the front of the cover, which is had to be a heavy stock cover out of necessity, was a little four-pointed diamond, a little Eclipso gem.
Oh, jeez.
Which, you know, that's all well and good. That's fun, DC. But you know what happens when you put that in with the rest of your comics? Whatever is a frickin' in front of that has a Eclipso gem embossed into its pages.
That's right.
It was a nightmare to pack, to ship, to put in a bag, because that thing stuck out.
But here's... okay,
like
so
a good eighth of an inch.
So here's the thing, right, about Image. We can say all of this about Image. We can say they missed deadlines. We can say that they put coupons in their books so that you would have to buy all their books to get their one
issue.
Oh, don't
even remind me about the coupons.
You can say that they released multiple, you know, covers for every issue, so you had to buy them all. You can say that they had, you know, shoddy editorial mandate to actually, you know, copy edit their books. The none of the art made sense in a lot of books because you went from artist to artist because of these things and them trying to fill deadlines. But because of those lessons learned, Image was one of the first companies to dump all that. Once they were on the brink of failure with all of their books, they were the first to go after the crash that they were in part, you know, in implicit in.
They were complicit.
They dumped everything, went back to since then. They have not been had very many variant covers, and they went to an idea of bringing in the best talent that they could with their own individual ideas and putting them out. So now we get The Walking Dead. Now we get Sex
in fact,
Criminals. And
Walking Dead is a good example. Prior to that, Player versus Player, which was a web comic that became so phenomenally popular and much the vein of like Axe Cop. Or it escaped the web.
Right.
But what Image was doing there was actually taking a leaf from Dark Horse's book.
Okay.
Part of how Dark Horse found market share was being shrewd enough to do two things. One was to bring back the anthology comic.
Okay.
Which is probably the worst business model ever, you would think. Yet it worked because they had good stuff. And they got some of the best independent creators in the world, and they brought iconic characters to the fore. I mean, a lot of what appeared in Dark Horse Presents is largely forgotten, except by its hardcore fans.
Mm-hmm.
But The Mask,
yes,
Hellboy.
Oh yeah, The Mask.
Concrete wasn't Concrete.
Concrete. Yes, Paul Chadwick's Concrete. So many iconic characters that would go on to, in some cases, leave Dark Horse for other publication routes, but this opened the door for some of these creators to put their stuff in front of people without having to foot the bill themselves. And Image, I think, recognized that is a very good approach to take to fill out, to flesh out your catalog, because they were founded on the concept of creator ownership.
Right.
And they really turn that part of the business into the industry on its ear.
Also, to their credit, they did bring out a lot of really good names and really, you know, some of my favorite artists from that era. And I know I'm going to get crap for it. I don't care. Brett Booth, J. Scott Campbell, you know, who only does covers now for some reason. I don't know why. Joe Madureira came and went and came again and just he was fantastic while he lasted as an artist, although I think that was partially even Marvel's doing in that case. because I know his first published art was in Excalibur.
Okay.
And it was like a team up between the team and the X-Men. It was like one of the first ones in years. And I think that was a big thing with Image too, that they actually took the time to introduce and develop new talent, and some of the new talent's still around today.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Rick, what are some good things that have affected comics since the 90s that came out of the 90s? You know, a lot of people could say that the crash gave us better books now, but I want to know some things that directly came out of the 90s comics, you know, whether it be creators, whether it be ideas, that you think still are in effect today and for the better instead of the worse.
I think, like, the ballsiness to bring in, like, controversial storylines.
Okay.
Definitely came into being in the 90s. And I reference The Death of Superman. I reference Nightfall. I reference...
Nightfall. That's actually a really good one, actually.
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Volume 2. You know, I think just being ballsy to bring in new ideas that are really going to piss off fans and at the same time please the other fans. I think that was a huge thing that they did in the 90s.
That's a very good and very valid point. But the thing about it is, there was this fine line that was always treaded with that ballsiness in some cases, like The Death of Superman, the Nightfall, that still is treaded to this day, perhaps veering more off the wrong side of that equation, is the idea of this, you know, how much of it is kind of ballsy storytelling and how much of it is just a cash grab. And like saying that, you know, things like The Death of Superman could easily be seen as a cash grab, but it also served as a catalyst for a lot of
other things.
Where nowadays, things like The Death of Human Torch is strictly a cash grab.
It was a full-on cash grab.
Yeah. Right.
But then we're skipping ahead into our decade.
Well,
the 90s definitely brought us that kind of sense of, hey, you know, if we can get away with this.
Mm-hmm. Right, but there's also the idea, there's a difference between the cash grab and, you know, if the 80s kind of teetered on the edge of, you know, starting to work as a large business trying to make money versus the idea of the rebellious artist trying to, you know, put good art out there. Mm-hmm. The 90s definitely divided that into two separate warring camps.
Yeah.
And you can... So we're talking about good, ballsy, good storytelling that you would not have gotten in the 80s and that led to you being able to see things throughout, you know, up to this point, you know, it reverberates. And I think there's one story arc that I know that Cole will agree with, there's one comic that I know Cole will agree with that did this in a way that it had never really been done before, and that was Starman.
Yes.
I know you have a special love for Starman.
Especially because I had no use for Starman when it was being published.
Right.
It looked like, oh, look, we're going to have take an existing character and make the new trendy, you know, modern, edgy version of him. Yeah, you know, go bite me. But the reality was, once I was convinced to give it a try, I was so amazingly, pleasantly surprised and completely blown away that, to my knowledge, for the only time in comics a recurring and ongoing series was deliberately written in the way especially a lot of British television is written, and to an increasing degree a lot of American television today is catching on to this, is, you know, this series is going to tell one story.
Beginning
to end.
It may
seem
it's
like
plotted.
A bunch of different stories, because there's a lot of little subplots going on. But at the end of the day, when Starman ran the course of its full story, it went away.
Yeah.
It got canceled, not because it was unsuccessful. It was canceled because it was done.
Right.
And that was an amazingly ballsy move for a publisher. Especially, you know, to skip ahead a little bit, when we see DC 20 years later, 20 or 30 years later, trying to bank on Watchmen.
Right.
Not being allowing that to go away. It's like, what's next? Are we going to do, like, Starman 2?
But, you know, and who wrote Starman? To further my point, who wrote Starman?
It wasn't Gaiman.
No, it was Grant Morrison, wasn't it?
Grant Morrison. Yeah.
So that was the birth of... They allowed this books like this allowed Grant Morrison to hang his giant balls on, to then go forward and do some of the most insane work on Batman that I've ever seen in my life with the death of Batman and with Batman R.I.P. and with, you know, all that stuff coming out of it, the stuff that he did on Justice League, the stuff that he did, you know, just from that point on, his storytelling. It rivals the greatest storytelling I've ever seen in my life because he's willing to take a chance, and those chances were taken in the 90s because it was that no-holds-barred attitude where a lot of the art styles didn't play well. They were, like I in my mind, they were big, they were overdone, they were over the top. But once those art styles were refined down, then you started getting stuff like the later, like the Tony Daniel stuff now, where it is a little bit over the top, but it's been reined in. Jim Lee's stuff now isn't like it used to be. It's very refined now. But it still carries that seal of being, being a little more extravagant, a little more exaggerated.
His stuff in the aughts when he did the Batman Hush storyline, holy crap, that's still some of my favorite artwork ever.
Right, it's Neil Adams quality Batman work.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't have had him doing that if he didn't have this.
Yeah.
So, I think it's also important to point out that, you know, talking about being, you know, the ballsy, putting things out in front and allowing them to happen, this is also the era that brought us the Vertigo imprint.
Hell yes.
And this is the point where, you know, like at some point in the publication of Swamp Thing, Swamp Thing was literally removed from the DCU.
Right.
Yeah.
To become part of the Vertigo imprint, which allowed him to sort of, I think Swamp Thing more than any other Vertigo character, because a lot of it is just standalone stuff and has nothing to do with the DCU.
Right.
A lot of it couldn't work in the DCU. But, you know, I think after a point where they sort of had told all the stories where there was going to be direct interaction with the DC Universe, Swamp Thing was sort of removed to this world that was a comfortable place for things like Sandman, things like Sebastian Oh, or... I'm drawing a blank on some of the other ones. But,
Preacher.
You know, Preacher, yes, was a Yeah, that left a giant footprint on the...
Yeah, it did.
And then there were so many other little things here and there. And I think it was also during the 90s that DC launched their Paragon Press imprint.
Yes.
Yeah. Which, oddly enough, was a tremendous hit-and-miss type of thing. But it brought things that would later be adapted into not only a different medium, but improved on vastly from the source material.
Right.
Like History of Violence.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
The four-issue History of Violence, or how many issues it was under the Paragon Press imprint, vastly different than the film, which is actually very well written. There's like so many things where this guy's like, okay, yeah, I'm sure you're trying to make it a little edgier, a little bit grittier, and that there's no logic involved with why that would even be part of the thing. But, you know, there it was. The damage was done. And I believe that, like, Road to Perdition was originally published by Paragon Press.
Yeah.
And this is where, you know, you see, much like a decade before or so, or two decades before even, the Epic imprint from Marvel had allowed for things to... Yeah, for the more adult theme, for the sort of stories that weren't part of what they, you know, weren't part of the normal discussion that any given month to month within those publishers' catalogs were about. These things really didn't belong. And, you know, granted, occasionally you get things that don't really belong in a given universe, under the regular imprints, but
right. But so you know, comics grew up even further in the 90s. And here's my question. We're starting to get to a point where we need to think about wrapping this up.
Mm-hmm.
So were the 90s the extinction level event that wiped the slate clean so that further evolution could take hold? You know, because we have things like Marvolution happen. Yeah, you know, we have things like the birth of the pro con versus the comic convention. Really started happening in the 90s, where you had,
mm-hmm.
you know, the pay for autograph, the giant weird booth, the con babes, the, you know, all
that
stuff.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because one of the things I failed to mention in our 80s episode was here on a very local level, the very first Dallas Fantasy Fair, which is the first convention, one of the first conventions I ever been to, the first big footprint kind of convention with tons of guests.
Mm-hmm.
Premiered in 1982 in Dallas. By the 90s, you speak of this sort of superstar, rock star, you know, there was Todd McFarlane and his giant entourage and his life-size
mm-hmm.
clown and Spawn figurines and his ex-roommate
being yep.
press-ganged into dressing up as Spawn.
Which I still have. I still have comics signed by that guy.
I remember going. This was the first time you were accustomed to. Occasionally, you'd run into film star celebrities charging for their autographs, but charging for an autograph was still fairly new. But this was the first time you saw a comic creator, most of whom were just glad to be there.
Right.
Yeah.
Demanding, extorting funds for their autograph. And I remember there was one artist who was at that convention, one of the big ones in the 90s, the fantasy fairs, who was saying, well, you know, I don't normally charge for autographs, but everybody else is, so I'm just...
Right, now it's
I'm
time
just,
to start.
I'm just charging a dollar, and then that's all going to go to charity. And I thought, you know, good for you.
I never paid for an autograph until the 2000s.
Well, by the 2000s, had really set in, and thankfully, to a large degree, it's not become universal.
Right. I know. Well, when I went to a Xena convention, yes, I went to a Xena convention to meet Lucy Lawless because
this
I had a crush.
This is a whole other show that needs to be had now.
There's a whole other show.
I went to a Xena convention. .org.
When I went to meet Lucy Lawless and Ted Raimi, I didn't pay for an autograph. Hell no! I didn't pay for an autograph at all.
But, you know, that was also a period where even in the media conventions, I remember Kathy and I standing in line for an hour and a half or 2 hours to get Marina Sirtis's autograph at a creation convention. They were limited to, either one or two autographs.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a pressed little time because of the colossal line going on.
Oh, yeah.
To interact, but she still, to the best of her ability, tried to interact in those few seconds that she had with each person. And you were allowed the requisite number of autographs and off you went, but there was mm-hmm. no further charge above the admission. It wasn't until much later, and even going further back, George Sakai had been to a couple of conventions in the Dallas area, and your ticket was pretty much your ticket to get things autographed.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things you start to see, especially by the 90s, is the advent of online sales.
Oh, yeah.
Prior to that, autograph sales were something either had to be, internationally famous to the point you couldn't leave your house without the paparazzi being there, and sometimes they were in your house,
mm-hmm.
To, you see the shift to everybody's autograph has value.
Right.
Some value. And I think that there was a sense that why am I... some guy, and you would see these guys come in to the conventions. Also, I think another reason comic creators were doing this is during the height of the bubble, right before it burst, autographs were seen as like value added, like grading is now.
It was, yes.
And, and you would see, I'd come in with my three comics, or a guy behind me would have five, and we'd all be standing in line behind the guy who brought in a long box.
Yeah.
Yes, that was something
God,
you would often see. I was completely okay with...
Obviously somebody who didn't give a fly in Dan about the comics themselves. He probably never read a single story, but he wanted to go back home to his little, little hole in the wall shop and profiteer off of having.
I'm completely okay with. I am still not okay with having auto. You pay for the privilege of coming into a show. You shouldn't have to pay for the autograph. That's the way
Agreed.
I look at it.
Agreed.
But if it's if somebody comes in, if it's over, you know, I'm okay with somebody limiting the amount of things they're willing to sign. Mm-hmm. I'm completely okay with them saying, okay, I'll sign, I'll write my name five times for you, and then I have to move on to the next person. Because I have personally been behind Long Box Guy. And that is, it makes everyone uncomfortable, not to mention the time that it takes.
Yeah, and it puts it puts the celebrity or the guest on the spot.
Yeah, right. It does.
Because then they feel responsible for the fact that there's this line of people with sore knees.
Yeah.
Because, you know.
You have to have 40 or 50 books signed, right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, by way of example, in the comic book realm, in the 90s, I guess it was, or maybe early 2000s, George Perez was at a Wizard World, Texas. And I brought in all my Who's Who to get signed. The actual pages for his art, which meant, you know, signing multiple times in any given issue.
Right.
And even though at the time I went in there, there were only two people getting his autograph, I would only bring him a few books at a time.
Right.
Yeah.
And I would go over, I'd rebag those, I'd give him a bit of a breather, and I'd come over and get a few more signed.
Yeah.
Because, well, you know, courtesy is something that sadly is a whole different issue to talk about on the show sometimes.
Well, it's the difference between treating somebody as somebody you respect and want their autograph because you respect their work and you enjoy it, and treating that person as if they were a commodity. And what we see in the 90s is the publishers starting to create, or more than starting to, embracing the fact that we, as collectors, are commodities. The people that work for them become their commodities. The comic shops that they're that Marvel's trying to take advantage of by doing direct sales of their own, or Diamond is delivering the comics to, but they're being provided the comics via, you know, DC or Marvel. They're treating Diamond as a commodity. Everybody becomes.
That's a very good point, because that is literally part and parcel what led to the Image Partners jumping ship. Because these were the superstars of Marvel.
Right.
And Marvel, and what was happening, I actually had occasion to hear Will Spratasia at a convention talking to someone about it, and I got in on the conversation. I was kind of like hanging around because I wanted to have him autograph something, but I was fascinated by this story. And one of the things I never realized was this was a period where Marvel figured out that a big way to make extra money out of what they'd already paid for. Let's say, you know, you're Will Spratasio and you've drawn, like, Wolverine. I don't know what the hell he drew for him, but let's say he drew a picture of Wolverine. You know, it appears in, like, the cover of the comic. Well, they could excise his Wolverine from the cover of the comic, slap it on T-shirts, mugs, you name it.
Exactly.
And sell that imagery to a licensee, and he didn't get a further dime. Oh, we've already paid you for that.
It's mine. It's my
art. Therefore, it is now ours, and we can reproduce it a billion different ways.
Right.
And you get nothing more for it. And they're like, you know, hey, I have a little sugar for Wills. And that wasn't forthcoming, so they're like, okay, guess what happens when your cash cows leave the farm?
Right.
Yeah, and I remember in an issue of Spawn where Spawn actually goes to hell and is met up with
a great issue
by Cerberus. I don't remember.
Cerberus.
Yeah, yes. Cerberus.
The aardvark was there as well.
Yeah.
Cerebus did appear in the Spawn.
Yeah, he gets taken to the hell of the multiverse, essentially.
Yeah, and he and you see this jail cell, and you just see the hands of like various superheroes. You see Batman's hand, you see Spider-Man's, the Hulk's, Superman, and they're all drawn in a way that you can recognize who they are. And then you see the artist chained to a wall, sitting with a chain around his neck and a bag over his head.
Right.
And Spawn is like, who are these poor bastards? And they actually go into the explanation. Oh, these are people who have had their creations taken away from them.
These are the Image Partners. What?
So
right, it was a big deal, and that led to Image spinning off, and that led to Image crap, you know, the idea that everything that they were doing was okay because they were a business and they were making money, and that went across the board, and that led to a giant bubble bursting crash within the industry that then led into a 20-year reconciliation of what had happened up to the point where we are at now, which I view as better. But
it was a long time coming. And,
right.
You know, you referenced the Marvolution, and that was really ultimately the in many ways, the pin that burst the bubble.
Right. Yeah.
Because both the publishers, the creators, fandom, were all just drunk on this heady vapor of, you know, this industry that just is an unstoppable juggernaut. And, you know, everybody was going out and buying multiple copies of everything they could get their hands on because they were convinced that what they had was an investment, and when they didn't have an investment. And the reason they didn't have an investment is, you know, Marvel, when X-Men number one with Jim Lee was published, it was a record-breaking, like, X number of million copies.
Oh, it was huge.
It was a world record for the publication of a single issue.
Yeah.
And as a thank you, they produced these little hologram things that I would later sell mine off for a nice price. But, you know, they had these little hologram things as, you know, thank you for letting us sell this. And it was, you know, like, this was a mark of distinction and pride. And the reality was that this was a sad testament to the fact that when you publish that much stuff, it's worthless.
Yeah.
You know, you're publishing this on rolls of Scott paper towel level production.
Mm-hmm.
And if I open my roll of paper towels and use it, it's about as valuable, barring, you know, a nuclear exchange or a zombie apocalypse.
Right.
It's not going to have any more value in 20 years. In fact, has less value, to the point where you find the still bagged issues of Death of Superman. You'll find the aforementioned X-Men number one with the gatefold one in quarter bins.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they have no value. There's too many of them. There's enough for every man, woman, and child in the world to have one.
They basically flooded the market is what they did.
Exactly. But we didn't realize that because everybody was so certain that this was the true golden age, as in, you know, this is pure spun gold, and Marvel and DC were printing money, and Image and Dark Horse were printing money, and that wasn't the case. And then Marvel took the next step.
Yep.
Because they had drunk so heavily from this draught that they couldn't see straight. And at this point, they were run by accountants who knew business, but they didn't know the business they were in.
Exactly.
That's one of the biggest complaints I have about that type of approach is you can go to business school and learn absolutely everything except how to run every single business in the world the way it needs to be run. And comics were not going to conform to a Wall Street model.
Right.
Yeah.
And the Wall Street model says, break away from this crap. Be your own man. And
well, the 80s saw us
devastated an industry, and then everybody suddenly realized that all their collectibles were worthless.
Right.
Yeah.
Because we were getting to the point now where toward the end of the 90s, people were starting to try to cash in.
Yep.
And they were bringing their long boxes into their local comic shop and being told, I've got 20 of this, I've got 10 of that. I got stuff I had to eat 10 years ago because I ordered too much.
Right.
What makes you think I'm going to give you a dollar for this?
With the 80s brought us the thought in the publisher's mind that they can make big money on this. The 90s saw them bringing in these CPAs fresh out of business school that in their mind can make it happen.
Yeah.
So let's just throw money at them and see what they can do. And this is what they can do.
Well, this was also the period in all kinds of business where money was getting kicked more up to the top.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, by way of example, Catherine's dad was an executive in an oil company, you know, from like about the 60s or something on to about the mid-80s when that particular company was destroyed in its own bubble bursting.
Right.
and he had the good sense to get out early. But the thing about it is the disparity between the top paid executive in that oil company and the lowest paid just starting out new hire,
right,
was multiplicative, where today it's exponential.
Right.
Because all the money is going straight to the top, and this misbegotten idea that if you throw all the money at the top, the money will still keep coming. And, you know, many a bubble has already burst because of that.
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what was happening with Marvel, is they were throwing all the money at the people they thought were going to make them more money, and the market was souring very slowly.
Yeah.
So, did we come out okay at the end?
I think so.
Like into the 2000s, as we wrap this up, and it is time to wrap it up, I think we've actually gone a little long, but at the end of the day, after everything that happened in the 90s, and I think that the 90s, there were a lot of good comics that were overshadowed by bad business. And I think that if we would have gotten those comics, if we could go back in time and stop the gimmicks and the chromium covers and the cash grabs, I think we would have seen through it and had a lot of good books come out of it that we could recognize. But I think it's just so overshadowed by the bad business practices and the cash grabs and the convention scene and all of that really turned people off. Do we come out the other side okay?
I think so, and the reason is because, I mean, for me, I was the wide-eyed, 13 to 18-year-old during that period, and I mean, so much so that at the time in issue 27 of Wildcats, I actually said to them that a comic book did change my life forever, and it was Wildcats, and the reason is because it got me into reading comics.
There you go.
And For me, as someone who grew up reading this stuff during the 90s, the 90s was my formative years as far as a comic book reader. And did it keep me reading? God, yeah.
Okay.
Did it stop me from reading anything? No, not at all. I think if nothing else, it just fueled my hunger for more.
Good. Cole, what about you?
I think you can kind of define the answer to that question by looking at Scott McCloud's seminal and constantly nominated / winning, Harvey Award winning publication, Understanding Comics.
Okay.
Which was, Scott McCloud had done a book called Zot, which was not to be confused with Jot, which would appear on the Children's Hour. but it was a book that was kind of like a primer on comics, in many ways ideally timed, because this is a period where everybody was trying to, a lot of people were jumping into comics who had no real idea what they were doing. This was published in the 1993, and then continued to remain in publication ad nauseum. I personally had the good fortune to attend the Harvey Awards 3 times, and Scott McCloud was nominated and won 3 times in the same category, to the point where I think the third time he finally said, please do not put me on the ballot. Because he was, inadvertently overshadowing a lot of good talent because nobody had read anything else.
Yeah.
And they'd all heard, all the people who could vote, oh, I know this one, I don't know these.
Right.
And, in the way that all of these industry award type things are meaningless, because it all comes down to who bothers to actually have a working knowledge versus just ticking check marks off in a box. But the thing that is, he would go on in 2000 to publish a sequel to Understanding Comics called Reinventing Comics.
Okay.
And Reinventing Comics, to me, is highly suggestive of the fact that as we're coming out of the 90s and the bubble has burst, we go into a panic period in the 2000s.
Right.
Where, obviously, your rank-and-file collector isn't going to retire on their comics. As an industry, a lot of bad business decisions nearly wrecked it. You know, Marvel goes bankrupt, and like the railroad, started really making some money. Once you get those pesky creditors out of the way, you can really start to make some cash.
Sure. But
to me, I never read McCloud's Reinventing Comics, but the crux of it was, you know, where do we go from here? And, you know, where do comics need to head? How are they going to survive? And that's been the drumhead for the last 20 years. And the more they beat it, the more they're drowning out the sound of the cash registers that never stopped ringing.
Right.
And therein lies your answer to, did we come out of the 90s okay? We did. We just didn't know we did.
Right, exactly.
We were so terrified of the change that we assumed that it was all over. And it's been all over. And we talked about that on an entire issue.
Right.
Called the never-ending eulogy. That was the never-ending eulogy issue.
Lauding the end of comic books as we know it every 2 years for...
They're gone this time. We're pretty certain.
Well, and you know what's funny is I look at it like this, right? There's this... Coming into the 90s and through the 90s, there was a... And then out of the 90s, there was this idea. The question was, how do we survive, right? And I think we go through the end of the 90s, after the burst, the late 90s, and into the 2000s with this idea of how are we going to survive, like you were saying. Eventually, the scales tip to this, there's this less vocal minority saying, how do we become better? Not just survive, but be better. And that slowly, the scale tips slowly towards that voice over the next 10 years.
Absolutely. It's less about how do we survive, but how do we become better and therein survive? Because if you become better, survival is the inevitable consequence.
Right. So how do we write better stories? How do we give people more creative license and more money for what they do? How do we get less cash grabby and still make as much money? How do we, you know, and all of these, and they're trying to, the next 10 years are basically like if we went in, took a group of people and colonized Mars. You know, it's okay, we have a basic understanding of where we need to be. How do we get there without doing what we did to destroy the planet of Earth?
Yeah.
You know, so do we build these tents or do we irrigate this land? You know, and so it's this trial and error period, which we'll get into next episode of what works and what doesn't, what can we try and what doesn't, how do we pay people and how much creative license and how much, you know, license over their own creativity do we give them and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. All right.
And we're turning into a modern movie trailer where we're giving you the entire movie in the trailer.
We are. And then in the background. Rick, thank you. Do you want to do some plugs for us, Rick?
Sure, why not? You can check us out, and of course, and by us, I mean myself, Cole, and Andy, on UnitedStatesOfGeekdom.com. We're on Facebook under United We Geek. We're on Twitter under Join the USG. We're about to hit 100 episodes very soon, and
nice.
we have a very special thing planned for episode 100 that Andy pitched at me as far as what topic we were going to talk about. So,
well,
yeah.
I just told you what you already wanted to hear. That's all
It's baseball, isn't it?
It's baseball.
Yeah, probably. It's baseball.
I got so into the pitch part, I forgot.
It's the 1989 Chicago Cubs cast. That's what it's going to be.
It's Dodgers baseball. Is what
all
it is.
All Ryan Sandberg all the time. That's what we're going to talk about.
You can also check out my Disney podcast that I do with my buddies Roy and Ben. That's rediscoveringthemagic.blogspot.com. It's on Facebook under Rediscovering the Magic with Rick and Friends podcast. It's also on Twitter under Fantasmacast. We have a shared email address for both shows, which is unitedwegeek@yahoo.com. We have a very special thing that we're working on. Should be out very soon. More details very soon. It's going to be fun. That's all I'm going to say. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Okay, Cole, what about you? What do you got for us?
Well, we're, of course, coming to you through the Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com. You can write to us at JCUmail@yahoo.com. We're on the Twitters as at the Jedi call you. We now have a slightly ever-expanding YouTube channel, the Jedi Call Universe, and we'll probably soon be on other social interwebs and such. And of course, as always, if you're in Texas, near Texas, like Texas, and you like the convention scene, want to be a part of it, know what's going on where and when, visit Convention Awareness Project Texas and our new, shorter, more abbreviated, and thank you to Jeffrey Carlton for making this happen, web address of www.cap-tx.info.
There you go. And don't forget, tomorrow you can see Cole and I live on deepalumonair.com.
deepalumonair.com on the whichever one of those shows it is. Hey Kids Comics Live.
That's that one,
not
yes.
Not the Rancor Pit Live. That's also there. But, yes, second Saturday of every month we'll be there. And then we'll probably have to take a nap at some point.
Yeah, we've been hitting it hard on this story arc, so we're going to have to take a nap. Rick, thank you so much for coming out.
Yes, thank you for adding that 80s feel. I especially like the fact that Rick actually, just for this episode, grew out a mullet.
He had a rat tail, and he was wearing a puffy starter jacket, and he had some Zubaz on. It was awesome. Thanks, Rick.
Joe Matarara, if you're listening, I want my issue 9 of Battle Chasers. Just saying.
You know, I wouldn't mind issue. Wasn't that in the 2000s though?
That was in the 90s.
Oh, was it?
90s.
Was it?
Yeah,
mid
to late 90s.
God, that's right, because that's when I was going to stuff like Chicago Comic Convention back then. Yeah. Okay. All right. So join us next time when we discuss the aughts, the 2000 through 2010, and how the comic industry dug itself out from the rubble of the crash and became better for it. All right, guys. Say goodnight.
Good night, everybody.
Peace.
90s peace. Too legit. Too legit to quit.
Hey.